America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends. 665 days, 664, 666. Depends on how you're calculating it. Is the last day that Bush is in office when he hands over the presidency to the next president a day that he's president? I suppose. Anyhow, if you don't count that, and you don't count today, it's 664 days, 12 hours, 49 minutes, 44 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily. You know, barring any last-minute things that might be brought about by, for example, a woman named Monica. We'll talk about that a little later on in the program. However, right now, on the line with us is Congressman Charles Rangel of New York, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. And Congressman Rangel, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Two issues I wanted to talk to you about this morning. The first is your proposal for essentially a national draft, a military draft. Give us your take on this.
Well, I really believe that anyone who believes in this war or believe that our country is seriously threatened should want to do something to protect her. And this is the first war in our history and probably in other countries that a country's at war and only a small group of people are really making the sacrifice. It's probably just untold that you could have tax cuts and trillions of dollars while you're spending billions of dollars in a country that you shouldn't even be in. And so it just seems to me that if you believe in the war, you have to believe in the draft. And if you don't want the draft, then the war's not worth fighting.
Yeah, I would suggest that the draft back in the 60s and 70s was one of the reasons why the Vietnam War actually ended.
There's no question about that. When the people know people that are dying, know people that are making the sacrifices, and they get fed up, the Congress moves. It's been five years now, and there just has been no outrage by the churches, by the synagogues, and now it's finally taking in the Congress, and I'm just pleased, as slow as the movement is, but at least people recognize that innocent people are putting their lives on the line in the military when they say that there's not going to be a military victory. How do you attend the funerals of these heroes, these warriors who believe in their commander-in-chief, believe in the flag, believe in their commitment, and tell them that they died even though the country knew that they couldn't win? It's disgraceful.
Yeah, well said. I have been an advocate for many years of a national service program. I lived in Germany for a year and saw it work there, where every high school graduate had to spend a year. I think it's just the young men. It could have been there. In some countries, it's both. Had to spend a year either in the military or volunteering with an approved nonprofit, hospitals, relief organizations, those kinds of things. Is that what you're suggesting, or are you suggesting just a straight, hard military draft, you know, bang, you're in the Army?
Oh, no. Very few kids would be involved in the military aspect of a mandatory system. As a matter of fact, we also include in our bill the ability to get an education, which is one of the major problems that we have in this country. Lack of access to a decent education is really a threat to our national security and should be treated that way. And the whole idea of high-tech jobs being sent overseas because we're not qualified for them, the number of kids that are dropping out of high school, I think that should be a part of the mandatory national service. But as you pointed out, we need mature people in terms of our security at home, in our hospitals, our schools, our airports, our seaports. And this should be something that would make every youngster proud to be able to wear some type of a patch to let America know that we're having a low period in terms of our national pride, in terms of our ability to be competitive. And what happened in Katrina never should have happened. And to think of the assistance that young, trained people could do in times of emergency, whether they're natural emergency or whether they're terrorism attacks, that We need educated people to help. And I'm certain that even though there might be resistance initially, nobody leaves the service without some sense of pride that they made a contribution to this great country. But, of course, we have to somehow instill some confidence in the commander-in-chief. You just cannot believe any time you can take a country to war and everything that you said was the reason for the war was bad intelligence, then a president should be removed from office for lack of intelligence in selecting the people they're supposed to advise. Putting people in harm's way, the loss of 3,000 lives, 30,000 kids that are permanently wounded, and hundreds of thousands of innocent people that we said we were going to set free, that's going to be a blot on our nation's great history that will take decades to remove. And to regain the respect of our fellow people in this world that we need in order for survival, getting back credibility is going to be quite a problem.
Congressman Rangel, your political opponents and those who are opposed to a national service program that includes a component of a draft suggest that what you're doing is just political theater. You're just trying to cast the light on the reality that you know, so many of the people in the military, certainly not all of them, but so many of the people in the military are going into the military now because of up to $40,000 signing bonuses and this sort of thing, and that really there's no chance of this passing. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's true that, you know, there's good theater, there's bad theater, and I really believe that that when people think about a draft, they think about their kids and their loved ones. And I constantly ask the question, do you believe the war is serious enough and important enough and a threat to our national security so much that you would put one of your kids in harm's danger? And if the answer is no, then it's hypocritical. So when you say draft and war, it is to bring it to people's attention. I don't see where there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, no, it seems actually like a good idea. If I may change topics real quickly just for a moment here, there's an article in today's Wall Street Journal that involves you. Democrats' trade agenda presses on wider Bush goals, and it says it's talking about these trade initiatives and that you folks are trying to get more, and the House Ways and Means Committee and many of the Democrats trying to get more protections for labor and environment into our trade pacts. From the founding of this country until basically Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush, the last four presidencies, up until that time, up until about 1980, we had this notion that if you could make a pair of shoes in New York and it cost a dollar's worth of labor to make that pair of shoes, and somebody wanted to make that same pair of shoes in Mexico where it cost 20 cents worth of labor, or in China where it cost 10 cents worth of labor, that was fine. But when those shoes hit the border of the United States, coming from China, there would be a 90 cent tax, and coming from Mexico, there would be an 80 cent tax, so that no matter where you made them, the cost was a dollar. And that was the only reason why we made shoes in the United States for, you know, 200 years. It's the only reason why we made clothes in the United States and all these other things that could be done more cheaply with labor outside the United States. But we didn't, because we had protective tariffs. What's wrong with just scrapping all these trade agreements that are so friendly to these multinational corporations and going back to a tariff-based system that built this country?
Well, I don't think that you can really be competitive with high tariffs. I think that the free marketplace, as long as you have a safety net there and are creating new jobs and improving the quality of life for people in your country and allowing developing nations to be able to get involved by taking the low-skill jobs, I think if you had a safety net and protection and you invested in the education of your country, you can improve the quality of life. And I think that without tariffs, that's the way it can and should be. Of course, that's assuming that everyone plays by the rule, and China doesn't play by the rules, and so therefore we have such a tremendous deficit there. In addition to that, we have the way you just talked about the Ways and Means Committee, it's a little more important that the Congress does have the responsibility and the authorization to do commerce and trade. And the problem that we have is that you can't have 535 members of Congress negotiating trade agreements. So we pass this authority off to the U.S. trade representatives representing the president. But they acted as though it was just the Republican trade policy instead of a congressional trade policy. And so the battle that we're having now is that Democrats are in charge, and we are shattering the myth that only Republicans can have input into our trade policy. And so we want to protect the working rights of people in the United States and in the developing countries. We want to protect the environment, and we want to make certain it's not worker abuse. And so that is what we're working on, and it's very timely. I didn't know about the Wall Street article, but as chairman of the committee, I will be reporting to full Democrats that we should not allow the Republicans to control the policy.
I think we just lost Congressman Rangel. Yep, apparently his cell phone just died. Well, it was Congressman Charles Rangel, Charlie Rangel, who is the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Democrat from New York. Great to have you with us, Congressman.
Or maybe he just didn't like my discussing trade pump. No, Charlie Rangel's a stand-up guy. Anyhow, 17 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on in the news here. We'll get back to it right after this break. We'll be right back. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. Yesterday, by the way, just to wrap up Charlie Rangel and that whole conversation, I have said for a long time that I think that it is psychologically healthy for adolescents and young people who are developing to have some sort of a rite of passage. And in fact, when you look at you know, the history of a lot of religions, there you find those rites of passage. Whether it's, you know, making a big deal out of high school graduation, whether it's a bar bat mitzvah, whether it is confirmation in the Catholic Church. I mean, there are these traditional, essentially variations on what used to be known or what are still known, you know, called in, among indigenous and aboriginal societies as puberty rites or rites of passage, where a young person makes the transition from being a child to being an adult. And I think one of the problems that we confront in our society, at the risk of delving too far into the woo-woo world of psychobabble, but nonetheless, I'll put a toe into this, I think one of the problems that we face is that there isn't that rite of passage any longer. And, you know, for many of us, that rite of passage took a lot of different forms throughout the course of our lives. You know, leaving home in your teens, going off to college, a rite of passage, and still is for many kids. Becoming, you know, politically active, a rite of passage, hitchhiking around the country, something that you could do safely back when I was a kid. It isn't done anymore, but traveling. I mean, there's a lot of different forms of rites of passage. And I think that, frankly, a national service program where you can choose to either participate in the military or participate and serve your country in a way that's more like a domestic Peace Corps, or perhaps even the International Peace Corps should be included in that, would be a really good and healthy thing. So that's my take on it. And I know that there are people who go, oh, no, that's slavery.
And many of those same people would say the same thing about paying taxes. I think that it's, you know, part of the price of being a member of a civil society, an organized civil society. Iran would be tackled at the beginning of April. Thus reads the translated headline from an article that Novosti, the Russian newspaper, which you can find at fr.rian.ru. This is a Russian newspaper that publishes in French. This article is not available in English. It's odd. It's screaming headlines in Germany and in France. But as far as I can tell, no U.S. newspapers have picked this story up. This from the tail end of last week. And this is the bad Google translation from the French of the Russian newspaper. The Russian military experts estimate that the planning of the American military attack against Iran passed the point of non-return on February 20, when the director of the IAEA, Mohammed El-Baradei, recognized in his report the incapacity of the agency to confirm the peaceful nature of the nuclear program of Iran. And then they go on and talk about how, you know, this was the point of no return. And then they go on to say, the analysts affirm that strike them American, that the Americans will strike, and it will be launched from the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, from where we'll take off the bombers with long operating range B-52s and their onboard cruise missiles. By the embarked aviation of the American aircraft carriers deployed in the Gulf and belonging to the 6th American Fleet in the Mediterranean, cruise missiles will also be drawn since the submarines concealed in the Pacific and off Arabia. At the same, you know, now this is really interesting. And then they go on, you know, result, the Iranian nuclear program will be rejected several years behind. Again, this is the translation from the French. In other words, we're going to shut down their nuclear program. That's going to be the rationale. At the same time, today, we began war games in the Persian Gulf. Is this a lead up to April 6th? Are the Russians right about this? And is a woman named Monica going to bring down the Bush administration? Man, there's so much to talk about today. We'll cover all these things in your calls when we come back from the news, or the break at the bottom of the hour, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Back to the radio support group of By and For. We the people of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Two other quick pebbles I want to drop into the water here, and then we'll go to your calls. The first is Monica Goodling. She is the Justice Department's White House liaison, the person who is supposed to communicate what Alberto Gonzalez and company come up with to presumably Karl Rove and friends over at the White House. And she has now said that if she is called before Congress, she intends to take the Fifth Amendment. Now, what's interesting about this is that the Fifth Amendment specifically says that it only applies in criminal cases. And to the best of my knowledge, there is not a criminal investigation going on right now. There's a congressional investigation, but the Fifth Amendment, nor shall any person... Nor shall he be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. So is Monica Goodling like giving us advance notice that there's criminal activity going on in the Justice Department or the White House? And wouldn't it be interesting if it turns out that Monica Goodling in the Justice Department, the woman who's taking the Fifth, who's kind of, you know, thrown this all onto the front pages by doing this so publicly, that she becomes the one that brings down the White House. And then you've got two presidents in a row who were severely wounded, shall we say, at the very least, by a woman named Monica. What is there about women named Monica? It's, you know, it's like, you know, what is it about people who are Tauruses or Virgos or whatever? It's very strange. Number one. And number two, the other thing that I wanted to just drop out there, and then we can talk about these as we go through the next 2.5 hours. Although we will at the top of the next hour, we're going to have a debate with a conservative, Richard Ralston, about health care in the United States. So we'll slightly change the topic there. But in any case, the other point I wanted to make, speaking of health care, now it was announced today that Tony Snow has cancer, and it has metastasized, or his cancer has returned, and it's metastasized to his liver. And, you know, first of all, Tony Snow is a human being, and I'm sure a decent human being, and my prayers are with him, and I hope yours are as well. And listening to, going back to the 60 Minutes, frankly, in my opinion, hit job on John and Elizabeth Edwards that Katie Couric did this last weekend, a dimension of that hadn't occurred to me yesterday when we talked about this was laid out in a blog here in Oregon by Kari Chisholm. He has a blog called blueoregon.com, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And what Kari pointed out essentially is that Katie Couric was posing the assumption that the Edwardses were faced with a binary choice, that there were only two choices, that they could either pursue their own self-aggrandizement of some sort, which would be, well, let me just put it very simply, they could either pursue their own self-aggrandizement or they could come together as a family and pursue their family. And you could make the argument that if John Edwards was running for, say, anchor of the CBS Evening News, and he chose to continue working while his spouse had cancer, that he was pursuing his own self-aggrandizement at the cost of his family. You could make that argument, I think. But what Kari Chisholm points out at BlueOregon.com this morning, and I think he's so spot on, and it was the piece that I was reaching for yesterday, and it was just out of my grasp, is that there's a third option. And that third option is that service to your country and bringing peace to the world and making this planet a better place for 6 billion humans and hundreds of millions of other life forms is bigger than self-aggrandizement. It's different than self-aggrandizement. It is the kind of mission that you can commit yourself to. I've been working on a book of the month review for BuzzFlash.com. I do one every month for them. And this weekend I got it about half done, and I sent Mark Carlin a note, the editor over at BuzzFlash, saying, you know, I haven't finished this thing yet. I'm sorry. It just, you know, everything has come down on me. I'm behind on a book deadline and you know, doing two radio programs and blah, 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 blah. And he sent me back a note saying something to the effect, and this is from one workaholic to another. I know Mark, and he puts in 16, 17-hour days just like I do. And he said, you know, don't burn yourself out, or words to that effect. And I replied saying, I'm very fond of the George Bernard Shaw quote. And I'm paraphrasing it from memory, so it's probably not exactly accurate. But George Bernard Shaw said words to the effect of, when I die, I want to be all used up. Or I want to be all used up when I go. And, you know, that really is kind of my life philosophy. And Mark replied saying, me too. You know, and I know he's absolutely right, because he's, you know. And that essentially is what John and Elizabeth Edwards are saying. That she's going to go all the way to the end believing that her husband becoming president would be the very best thing for this country and for this planet, for humanity and for all life on Earth. And that's a noble cause. And committing yourself to a noble cause while you're fighting cancer is arguably the best thing somebody could do. You know, in the context of the cancer or outside of the context of the cancer. And so I want to tip my hat to Kari this morning for putting that into words. He said, if you think that running for president is about changing the world and you have the ability and an opportunity to affect the lives of millions in an important, meaningful, and positive way, then how could you stop running for president? If you believe you have a calling to do great things, a mission to serve America, then how could you possibly drop it, even in the face of cancer? If this is the most important thing that you could do with your life, how could you stop, even if that life looks to be a little shorter today than it did last month, especially if, and make no mistake, this is as much a mission for Elizabeth Edwards as it is for John. And that was the comment. I played that clip yesterday where Katie Couric, you know, said, you know, your life may be short. And Elizabeth Edwards said, all of our life, you know, we're all going to die. We're all confronted with, now I'm not quoting her, this is essentially what she said. We're all confronted with mortality, and we're all confronted with the question, what are we going to do with the rest of our lives? And the Edwardses have decided to take on a noble mission, and I think it's just marvelous. Jack in San Diego, California. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, you know, you made a good point about the Fifth Amendment. Just as a point of reference, that is the reason why O.J. had to testify in his civil case.
That's right. That's right, because it was not a criminal proceeding, and because he was immune from criminal prosecution at that point, because it would have been double jeopardy, which is also included in the Fifth Amendment. Now, the reason, however, why mobsters in the past are famous for, you know, take the Fifth, you know, it's Trafficante and Marcello and all these other guys, when they got up before Bobby Kennedy, is that they weren't given immunity. That's why Congress gave, for example, Ollie North immunity, so that he couldn't refuse to, so that he couldn't take the Fifth. He had to testify.
Well, you know, the only thing I'm thinking of here is that maybe, see, I don't know. You make a good point. Could Congress disallow her taking the Fifth?
Yes, or and the way that they do that is by giving her immunity, which is what I think they should do.
Well, that's where I was going. That's where I was going. But could you make the argument that you can take the Fifth in a civil proceeding if what you say may lead to a criminal charge? But I did want to bring up that reference with Monica Lewinsky because she didn't want to testify either, and they gave her immunity, and then you have
right.
to testify. And if you recall, Susan McDougal was given immunity. She still refused to testify, and they sent her to jail.
That's right. That's right. Good
so
point,
that's Jack. That's the answer to get around this Fifth is give them immunity. I mean, we're not after Monica Goodling. What we want is the top dog. We want Gonzalez. So give them immunity.
Yeah, Gonzalez. Or you know, in my opinion, this is the pattern of Bush and Rove, and you know that this you know everything for politics. I mean, Bush basically back in 1999, Bush told his biographer Vicki Herskowitz that if he got elected to office, he was going to have a war because it would give him political capital. And you read Paul O'Neill's book, you know, with Ron Suskind, that the very first meeting that the cabinet had was all about how do we attack Iraq, and this was in January of 2001.
Well, so, I think interesting, Tom, is the fact that they routed their emails through the RNC.
Right.
That goes to premeditation.
Yeah, that's my point. That's my entire point, Jack, and you made it very well. Thank you. Is that it's all about politics. It always has been. And, you know, well said. Thank you for the call. Paul in Carbondale. Hey, Paul, we have about a minute before we have to take a break. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to say that I think Charlie Rangel is astoundingly immoral when he talks about, when he talks about we have to have more American kids dead to stop the war. So far, we've had 3,000 dead Americans and 600,000 dead Iraqis. In Vietnam, we had 53,000 dead Americans and 3 million dead.
I think, Paul, what he was suggesting is that the threat of a broader spectrum of American society being dead in the war will be enough to stop the war.
Really? Because Democrat Congress can't even cut off funds, and so what he wants to do is give this crazy person more people. I think the only thing that's stopping Bush from fully realizing his imperial agenda is the lack of soldiers, because they just make up more money. They just,
right, but
you know,
that's with an all-volunteer army, though. You get soldiers who are compliant to you. With a draft, you get soldiers who are questioning you.
How can you use people's lives like that? That's
immoral.
For your own political agenda.
Well, it's not my political agenda. It's the nation's. Okay, Paulie, point me. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
get up every morning and ignore the global warming. Head out to the Oval Office, start my day. I keep my donors all protected so I can be re-elected. Give them access just as long as they pay. And to the corporate crooks who keep cooking up the books, we make sure we look the other way. The laws are theirs to break, long as I still get my take. My war chest keeps on growing each day. And I've been taking care of business every day.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Bennett in Los Angeles. Hey, Bennett, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I think you're dead on about Elizabeth, at least about the Edwards. I actually saw them on Friday night, and it really seemed that Elizabeth is driving the decision. She talked quite passionately about all the people she had seen during the campaign and how none of them had cried on her shoulders. And, I mean, this was really a personal mission for her.
Yeah.
And
if I had a terminal disease, and the reality is that we all do, it's called life. But if I had one that was like looming and imminent, the question that I would be asking myself is not how to have the most, fun. Drugs do I want to try, or what fun palace, Disney World do I want to go to? It would be, how can I most effectively help change this world in a better way for my children and their children, before I die? And I think that that's what Elizabeth Edwards is asking herself, and she believes that the way to do it is getting her husband elected.
And I think it's also unfair because they've actually dealt with tragedy. I mean, they had their son die, and so they know how they can handle it. Same for Joe Biden, actually. But what about the other candidates? Then I'm asking them how they would handle something like that.
You're absolutely right. Good point, Bennett. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it, and I think it's well said. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, what's on your mind this morning?
Hi.
This afternoon,
two things, because I have the TV on all the time. You were talking about Tony Snow a minute ago. By the way, I just read your book. It's really, really good.
Oh, thank you. Which one?
Screwed.
Oh, great. Thank you.
You really write well. Didn't realize how much you worked on ADD before this, but I'll probably read some more of your books because you really do write well.
Well, thank you. But now we've distracted ourselves, and we're ADD off on another topic.
I figured if I
back to Tony Snow.
I figured if I kiss butt, you give me an extra minute. Two things I was thinking about. The second one, just first, because I'm listening to Joe Biden give a speech. I think it was probably on Sunday, probably New Hampshire. I'm not sure where. And I still think he's got the clearest vision for president, even though Barack Obama is, not a disingenuous figure. I still think Joe Biden's experience.
I've met Joe Biden, and I've heard him speak, and I've heard him speak in a small group setting, and his understanding of world affairs is mind-boggling. The guy is a true statesman, and he really gets it with regard to international affairs. I have some big problems with Joe Biden's, some of his domestic policies, and I think a lot of those probably stem out of the reality that this is politics is a money-driven business. And, on a few occasions, things like the bankruptcy bill and whatnot, he sold out. But I still think he'd make a much better president than most.
But what prompted the call was suddenly seeing the White House briefing on Tony Snow's health. Mm-hmm. And just as you were talking and just realizing how the attention was suddenly put on one individual's health from the White House, where the thousands of dead bodies and the thousands of maimed bodies, both American and the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi dead, just go unspoken about all the time. And it's just juxtaposition just suddenly chilled my spine.
It's an interesting point and an interesting way to make the point, Len. You did good. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening to WWRL there in New York. Gene in San Francisco, listening on The Quake, where I'll be Thursday night of this week, in fact. Hey, Gene.
Hi. I was interested in what you were talking about the Edwards. In the past, you've mentioned Maslow's psychological theories about self-actualization.
Yeah, his hierarchy of human needs.
Yes, And I believe that the Edwards' response to this tragedy is very much a sign of their psychological maturity and their self-actualization. If they were confronted with this survival situation and fell back to that position of just scrounging to survive, that would show their immaturity. But the fact that they can continue on in a mature psychologically, emotional, psychological maturity, as they are doing, maintaining their goals and their visions, that shows how mature they are.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, and very well said, Gene. Thank you very much. Richard in New York City. Hey, Richard. Bouncing back and forth from coast to coast here. Hey.
Good afternoon, Tom. I want to say that I fully understand Charlie Rangel's position in terms of trying to drive home the severity of the conditions by instituting the draft. But I have to take issue with him in terms of, I think if given the choice, he would actually make good on that threat. And the problem I have with that, at least in part, is that when you're in the military, your rights that are guaranteed to you under the Constitution are taken away from you.
Right, and that's one of the reasons why Charlie Rangel and his legislation and what I've been advocating suggests that there should be a whole range of options beyond the military. You know, essentially what he's suggesting is a program where actually, you know, poor kids who otherwise couldn't afford college can go to college as opposed. So I think frankly what you would see is fewer people going into the military because of the $30,000 and $40,000 signing bonuses that are being offered right now, and more people in the upper classes and middle classes who are just going down that college track and just ignoring the whole rest of the world, being thrown into a national service program, whether it's working in a hospital or whether it's working with an international relief agency or whether it's joining the military. I think it would be a bit of an equalizer. But,
while your suggestion does have more merit than Charlie Rangel's, I also have a problem with that position, simply because you're saying that, in a roundabout way, you're saying that from the moment of birth, you are indebted to this nation in some way. And
yes, I absolutely am, Richard, and I believe that to be the case. It's called the social contract, and you know, it's solid, it's real. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Today's New York Times. An article by Charles Duhigg, if I'm pronouncing it right. Aged, frail, and denied care by their insurers. Starts out with the story of Mary Rose Dirks, 65-year-old widow back in 1990. And she bought an insurance policy that would protect her in her old age. It would provide for hospitalization and medical care and nursing care and things like that through this company, Conseco. And now she's 81, and she has yet to receive a penny from them, even though her family has paid about $70,000. And then they yet thousands of policyholders say they've received only excuses about why insurers will not pay. And this article goes through in seven long and brutal pages, detailing how these insurance companies, these health insurance companies, are absolutely just screwing. I mean, you're just destroying the lives of people who have been paying money to them for years, in some cases decades, because they're trying to inflate the bottom line. Richard Ralston is with us. He's the executive director of Americans for Free Choice in Medicine, AFCM.org. The website. And Richard, you are an advocate of maintaining this current for-profit healthcare system.
I am. By the way, it's nice to talk to you again. I hope you're enjoying your new time slot.
Thank you.
Yeah,
we're having fun here.
Yeah,
it's actually the same time slot we've had for 4 years, but we've got a few new affiliates.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that. Well, don't stay there. Don't run off and run for Governor of Oregon or something.
All righty.
I am in favor of a for-profit system. I think there are many, many problems with the way the current system works. So I would definitely not advocate that the current system is something that should be preserved.
Well, let's look at some of the alternatives. You posted an article here, should the Veterans Administration take over all health care? And, you know, Larry Scott of VAWatchdog.org is a regular guest on this program, and they chronicle the, you know, sometimes the good, more often the bad of the Veterans Administration and what veterans need to watch out for. And one of the comments that Larry has made on a number of occasions is that most veterans will tell you that once they get into the system, once they get past all the difficulty of getting into the system, they actually have a very good healthcare system. There's a lot. There are very committed doctors and nurses, and the facilities are reasonably good. I know they've been, you know, badly mismanaged and underfunded over the last 5 years of the Bush administration. But what's wrong with essentially socialized medicine, which is what the Veterans Administration is?
Well, I actually think that the Veteran Administration, in terms of the medical care delivered, probably is, and even if it's not, it should be the best case for government medicine. I definitely feel that the Veterans Administration is not charity, it's not welfare, it's a well-earned employee benefit that the government owes and should provide to war injured veterans. And if they can't provide it, they should make sure it's provided by somebody. Now, I also agree with you on two points. I think the actual medical care delivered is probably pretty good. I haven't seen much evidence that it isn't. It's the administrative burden that messes everything up. They've got a backlog of 600,000 claims. It takes an average of 127 days to process a claim. It takes 657 days to process an appeal if you've got a problem with a claim.
Right, which all comes down to one word, which is funding. And
well,
if everybody in the United States was using this system rather than just a small, very small fraction of the population, which is wounded veterans, don't you think that we would all collectively raise hell and this system would be funded properly?
Well, I think who could raise hell better than these well-deserving veterans? I don't think VA problem is primarily funding. I think it's incompetence. You won't get an argument from me. I don't think the Bush administration could manage a ham sandwich. I don't think they.
So are you putting forward the argument? You're putting forward the argument then, Richard, which is a fairly, you know, well-oiled conservative argument that people who work in government and therefore are government bureaucrats are incompetent, but people who work in the for-profit corporate world and are therefore corporate bureaucrats, like at Conesco, this insurance company, they're, by virtue of the fact that they're working for profit, they are competent.
No, I would say any big bureaucracy can be incompetent. The only advantage that the insurance companies have is that there are other insurance companies, so that there are choices. So that people that have a problem with one insurance company can one sue if they're really doing something horrible, or in a free market they can go to another insurance company. Once
but if
we're
we
trapped
have,
into
if,
a single government system, there's no escape.
Well, not true. There's a thousand variations that can be made to a single government system by our elected officials, by we the people, you know, throwing people out or voting people in. I mean, we can say, no, we want more of this, we want less of that, we want to get it right.
I don't think...
That's one option. The other is the one that Bernie Sanders pushes, which is that, yes, we should have a national health care system, but every state should administer their own. Instead of Medicare for all, it should be Medicaid for all, and that way states that are particularly innovative can be incubators that other states can look at and go, hey, that's pretty cool, we can do that.
Well,
what's wrong with that? With single payer, where you have a single payer system. I mean, let me just lay this out, Richard. We're talking with Richard Ralston. He's Executive Director of Americans for Free Choice of Medicine, AFCM.org. The bottom line for me is that if you look at the cost of administering Medicare, or for that matter, the Veterans Administration, it runs between 2-3%. That's the total, you know, for every $100 spent, $97 more or less gets to actually providing medical services. In this private for-profit system that we have in the United States, uniquely out of the 37 industrialized countries in the world, we're the only one that does this, that still does this now, low these many decades. somewhere between 20 and 35% of all the money in that system sticks to the fingers of the corporations. It ends up as multi-million dollar, and in the case of William McGuire, the CEO of the second largest health insurance company in the United States, a $1.7 billion paycheck. It ends up as gold-plated faucets and the bathrooms of the Lear jets that they fly around in. It ends up in fancy headquarters. It ends up in the advertising that you watch on TV at night. It ends up in the salespeople all over the country who are out selling against each other. It creates massive inefficiency. Yes, there is efficiency at the level of the actual delivery of services. Maybe they can deliver services at 1.9% of cost or 2.1% of cost instead of 3%. But then you're loading that with the fact that they've got to pay 10% of their overhead, or 10% of their revenue, rather, to their stockholders as dividends, plus they've got all these other expenses that don't exist in the government or the nonprofit sectors.
Two observations there. One, when you say the administrative expense as a percentage of what is spent, obviously the...
As a percentage of total revenue.
But the Medicare payout is much, because the people getting the services are older and sicker, is much higher. So in absolute terms, the administrative cost is about the same.
The reason that they've got that doesn't pass the smell test
is to review and control costs. Unlike the government, they haven't got an infinite tap of tax money or government debt to pay for the health.
The government's tap is not infinite. I mean, this is one of the problems that the VA has, is that they're underfunded. They're squeezing every nickel they've got. They can't even maintain their facilities. It's not that you got a bunch of people sitting around going, gee, I think I'll ignore the facilities today. It's that they don't have the money to do it. You have budgets in a government.
Medicare has plenty of money. The expense for Medicare has exploded.
And Medicare is providing good services to its users, although the poison pill that the conservatives put in with this, you can't negotiate with the drug companies, is you're right. It's nearly killing Medicare, and it's exactly, obviously, what they wanted.
Even if you're right, that's a three-year problem. We've got a 40-year problem. Medicaid in New York State costs $47 billion.
Yeah.
And it's turned into, as most government-delivered services do, into a political spoil system. The head of the health care workers union gets $400,000 a year.
And that's my
governor,
point. If everybody is
trying to get some control on that,
right?
That has corrupted both the Democrats and the Republicans in New York. So he's fighting a political establishment that is serving the spoil system and not the public in New York State.
And if it is serving, and the problem is that it's serving only a minority of people in New York State, and so only a minority of people in New York State give a damn about it. And if everybody in New York State had to get their services through that system, you can bet that that system would be far more politically responsive. On the other hand, try and call William McGuire at United Healthcare and talk to him on the phone.
Well, but you're saying that the winner of a presidential election will determine how the guy behind the cage at the Department of Motor Vehicles or the Post Office will treat you.
I think more at the level of Congress, but yeah, that's what I'm saying. And you disagree. Okay, people can check out your website for more information. The Executive Director of the Americans for Free Choice in Medicine, AFCM.org, Richard Ralston. Richard, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Said, "You're honorable, would you mind taking 20 minutes if you ever find the time to figure out some health care that would work as good for me as what you fellas got yourself in Washington, D.C.? So if you get appendicitis or a splinter in your hand, I hope you're in New Zealand, Libya, or Switzerland, or somewhere else where they have somehow figured out a way keep you upright till the good Lord says that it's your day." Hey.
Indeed, Isn't it amazing? Muammar Gaddafi in Libya has a national health care system. We don't. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number, 1-866-303-2270. You can drop by our live chat room at tomhartman.com. Just click live chat up at the top of the page. CommonDreams.org. I submitted a piece to them yesterday, which was a summary of the rant I did the day before yesterday about how James Madison in the Constitutional Convention was arguing, or excuse me, in his first term as a legislator, as a congressman, was arguing that if the president were to fire honorable men, meritorious men, wantonly, he should be impeached. And so, you know, I sent that into Common Dreams, and I went through Madison's text, and I popped out and bolded the sentences that I thought were particularly relevant, and somehow all the formatting got lost. So if any of our friends from Common Dreams are listening, please fix it, because it's a great piece, I think. It's mostly James Madison, but it's a lot easier to read with that bolded text in there. The whole issue here about health care, I think, really boils down to two things. One is health care a right or a privilege? When the Constitution talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, excuse me, the Declaration of Independence talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And when the Constitution talks about the general welfare of the people, is it reasonable to construe within that language the assumption that one dimension of life is being able to survive illness, and one part of the general welfare is our healthcare system? Every other industrialized country in the world, and many of the non-industrialized countries in the world, have come to the conclusion that yes, it does. That among the human rights that we hold self-evident is the right to life. That is, to live in the face of illness. I think this is really being brought to the fore now with Elizabeth Edwards and Tony Snow and their cancers, respectively. And, you know, my take on it is that we should follow the model of, there's a number of other countries that have done this. This is not rocket science. You don't have to start from scratch and do it, although we can have a uniquely American variety. As I said, I'm very fond of Bernie Sanders' idea of single-payer health care systems in each one of the 50 states. And so you have, you know, you, like Medicare does right now, or Medicaid does right now, rather, excuse me, you have some funding from the state and a fair amount of funding from the federal government to help the states out. And the state provides health care to everybody in the state. And all the different states do it however they think is best. And over time, the states will look at each other and go, you know, what we're doing here seems to be not working as well as what they're doing over there. So let's recalibrate this. And state legislatures are quite close to the people, and they're frequently reelected. I mean, typically state legislatures turn over, at least the House of Representatives of most states turn over every 2 years. And so they're going to be responsive to the demands and the upsets of the people. I'm not convinced that a socialized medicine system where the government actually owns the hospitals, owns the medical facilities, and hires the doctors is a good idea. But it'd be interesting to see a state try it. You know, there are two basic formulas for doing this. And then the third one is one of these two and a mixture of privatization in there, you know, as a secondary piece. That's what you find in, for example, the UK, where it's socialized medicine and that, or in Canada where it's single-payer health care and that. But basically it's socialized medicine or single-payer health care. And the two, and we have both of those in the United States. Socialized medicine is called the Veterans Administration hospital system. And single-payer health care in the United States is called Medicare. We have both these systems. And they function in the United States, and they function quite well. So the question is, why can't we just right across the board say, okay, we're going to pick one of these, and or both of them for that matter, and make them available to everybody? And the answer, of course, is that healthcare is such a lucrative business. It is such a profitable business. There are people becoming multi-millionaires on the business of sickness, basically, of keeping people well and of restoring people to health. Or, frankly, a lot of people getting rich in the business of denying people healthcare and services. And this is what this huge expose in today's New York Times is about. That their profit margin comes from how many people they can deny services to, who paid for those services for years, for decades, in some cases through most of their lives for. And, you know, why can't we do that? Well, we can't do it because we don't have the political will. More than 70% of Americans want this. And I predict that we will have it within 4 to 6 years. I think that Americans are just fed up. But, you know, the how are we going to go about doing it, that's a legitimate debate. We'll be back with your calls after 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Out in Taiwan, my gallbladder out in Greece. Took a side trip up to Sweden to fill some caverns in my teeth. Saw a doctor down in Denmark and a specialist in Spain to see what could be causing me this dull but steady pain. Took a trip up to Toronto just to buy some little pills. Thought I'd died and gone to heaven when they handed me the bill. Went to Norway when I noticed that my eardrum had a hole. Got back home just in time to watch the Super Bowl. It's been a brutal year, but man, I'm glad I was overseas, where you can see the doctor when you really got a need. Where people, they live longer, babies also like they should. I guess they call it healthcare, and I guess they got it good.
Oh, what a radical idea! 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Campaign for America's Future pulls some of these stats together. While George W. Bush and the Republicans in Congress cut $12 billion from Medicaid, 84% of the public support medical health insurance programs, publicly funded health insurance programs for our kids. 56% of Americans believe that the federal government should provide Medicare for all. 81% favor a minimum wage hike. 79% say Medicare should be able to negotiate with drug companies to get lower prices. Are you seeing these TVs on these ads on TV from pharma saying, oh, don't mess with Medicare. Competition is working. Wait a minute, competition? The government can't negotiate. Don't let the government negotiate with a drug company. I mean, it's like these ads are like, you know, black is white, white is black, red is green. The world is not round. Tom Friedman tried that one, too. It's equally nonsensical. It's really amazing. Really amazing. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Claude in Long Island, New York on the line. Hey, Claude, welcome to the program.
Hello, Professor. Thank you very much for all the work you've done. And also, I had to say that I cried in the middle of Unequal Protection. It was a great book.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay. I've been in healthcare for over 20 years, and I've gone to the rallies that we've had up here in New York and Albany every year to protest budget cuts that we've been doing for about 6-8 years now under Pataki, and now we just had our last one under Governor Spitzer, as I call him, Governor Shyster, because I was one of his people that voted for him and thinking we'd get a much better government. But as it is, what I feel is that really what they're doing is just doing the same thing that Reagan did, which ushered in the whole era of health care for money, which is break backs of unions, make nonprofits go along with whatever the corporate for-profits had to do, and really just roll out this way of taking funds out of the system that kept perpetuating itself through nonprofits, rolling the money back into themselves rather than back into their corporate structure of paying off the profit incentive of their stockholders. And it's really disgusting to have people who come on, like your person that you just interviewed, saying that veterans are the ones who are going to have to be left to fight for a better way of getting their health care because they're the best ones able to do it. I couldn't understand his rationale for that. Maybe you can help me. So now the veteran who's possibly still an active GI is supposed to buck the system that they're in to get their health care. What's wrong with that self-perpetuating circle of locution do I not understand?
Well, you know, I have a theory about what Richard was trying to say, but I have a policy of not challenging my guests when they're not around to defend themselves. I'm not going to put it forward. But I agree that it didn't make a lot of sense to me. But there are a lot of people who hold to that, Claude. And you know, I appreciate your call. I mean, the point that you made about Reagan is really well taken, because he's the guy who in the 1980s began for the first time in American history, began spreading the idea that our government is not a democracy, that government is the enemy, that it's somehow we should think of government the same way that the people living in the Soviet Union thought of the communist state, and we should be afraid of and hate our government.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And everybody would always laugh and applaud and go, yeah, Ronnie, there you go. As he is systematically taking apart democracy in the United States. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, well, Tom, very interesting guy. Richard Branson, I believe his name.
Ralston, like the pet food company.
Ah, thank you. Interesting guy. I just wanted to focus on one point, which I thought was really compelling about that fellow, where he said, and I think maybe this even speaks to the just previous caller you had, he said that one of the safety valve for getting bad health care is that if you're getting bad health care from the plan you're in, one of the safety valves is choosing as an individual another health plan or another health, you know, health care organization. Whereas if you have a single payer system, even if it's just on the state level, there is no escape. Now you're a rejoinder, obviously, which was, you know, well, you go to your elected representative. And, you know, as a group, as a state, or as a district, you vote for a change in that system.
Well, there's another rejoinder, and that, if I may interrupt you just very briefly, and I'll let you finish your point. The other rejoinder is that we don't have choice right now. If I decide to leave the health insurance company that I have right now and go with another health insurance company, they're going to say to me, any medical problem that you have that last health insurance company found out about, we're not going to pay for. That's not a choice.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm not in that situation because I'm fairly healthy and I can do that, I guess. But I my wife, yeah, she's had to deal with that because she does have a pre-existing condition. Well, she has employer paid health care, so it's not really an issue right now. But I guess I take your point. But I guess what I'm saying is that the thing that was so compelling about his point is that, well, yeah, you know, you can go to your elected representatives, but then you've got an entire district or perhaps even an entire state, or if you had a national system, an entire nation making a choice for you about what the best health care plan is. And yet with his point, what we've got is at least the choice is, you know, it may not be an easy choice, but the choice is still left up to the individual as to what the best health care plan is.
But Jeff, I would argue that we don't have those choices because you and I are not paying the doctor directly. There is a third party involved, and that third party is the insurance companies or the HMOs, as the case may be. And the insurance companies are playing all these kinds of games with us, and it's all about making money for them. They're the big winners in the whole thing, and we're the losers, and the docs are the losers, and the hospitals are the losers, and only the HMOs and the health insurance companies are winning. It's just there is no real choice in this healthcare market.
I have a question. I mean, here's the whole problem. This is why HMOs were invented, which is, you know, ultimately a government creation in the first place, the idea of a health management organization. Those were created by government. And the whole reason why they were created was for cost containment, because under the previous system, the doctor would send a bill to the insurance company, and the insurance company would pay off. Those were PPOs, which was, how they were, used to be, things were used for, you send out the bill, the insurance company would pay it off, the doctor had no incentive to economize, the patient had no incentive to economize, because they want all the health care they could get, obviously, and costs were skyrocketing. And so
when HMOs were created, the initial enabling legislation required them to be not-for-profit organizations.
So it's like we have either two bugaboos here. Either we have going back to the old system where costs continued to skyrocket and there was no incentive to economize, or we have an entire mob, you know, economizing for you, making these, you know, choices for you. And my argument is simply the best person to make, to economize their choices, and I think that, you know, the Richard's, you know, argument would be as well, is the individual. They should be really...
If you're wealthy enough.
Well, not
if you have if you have a big enough checking account that you can reach into your back pocket, pull out your checkbook and say, okay, I'm going to write a $20,000 check for this chemotherapy, or I'm going to write a $5,000 check for this PET scan. Yeah, you can go out and shop around.
But Tom, rich people don't have to economize. That's the point. I mean, of course, they never have to economize.
That's where your argument, and my point too, and that's where your argument breaks down, Jeff, is that the whole idea with something that is so expensive, I consider in the United States, 50% of all bankruptcies are the result of people getting sick, and 70% of those people had health insurance when they got sick. Compare that with Canada, where only 7% of bankruptcies have to do with sickness, and virtually 100% of those bankruptcies, the sickness precipitated the loss of employment, which is what led to the bankruptcy, not the medical expenses.
Well,
now, doesn't that tell you something?
Point taken, but there are a lot of other issues with the Canadian health care system that I couldn't possibly...
No, I'm not saying that it is a perfect system, Jeff, and I got to move along. I appreciate the call. It's a good conversation. I'm not saying it's a perfect system, but it's getting better. It's and ours should too. John in Los Angeles. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I lived in Japan for 15 years, and they have a single payer system there, and it was great. And
that was my experience in Germany also. I lived in Germany for a year with a single-payer healthcare system, and we, you know, the doctors would see us in some cases the same day.
Right. No, in Japan, really, it was absolutely fantastic, but there was something I think that they did which was really very effective, and that is that they did not prohibit anybody, any insurance company or anybody that wanted to compete with the government system instead of vice
right.
versa.
Yeah, that was the mistake that Canada made initially, was forbidding competition from the free market.
See. You know, in Japan, they allowed it. And I was teaching in Japan, and the school that I taught at had a small publishing company, and there was a union for publishing companies, and it was mostly the unions that would put together an insurance program, and mm-hmm. it was a little bit more expensive than the single-payer government system, but it was fantastic. It worked absolutely like a charm. I paid $2 for the first visit to a doctor.
Yeah, there's just a small piece of that. John, good point. Arigato gozaimashita for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, 1-866-303-2270, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Claudia in Los Angeles, California on the line. Hey, Claudia, what's up?
Hi. Thank you for being on the air. It's nice to hear someone intelligent on talk radio.
Well, thank you.
I'm a self-employed person. And have gone through medical insurance hell in all the years that I've worked, been self-employed and had to get insurance. My most recent disaster was with a company called Nationwide that was being sold by an insurance agent that convinced me this would be the best thing for me to get. with a low premium, but contained.
Claudia, I'm sorry, we can't do like personal stories that involve companies and things like that on the radio. Is there a point that you wanted to make?
Well, I wanted to make the point that this company that was selling particular savings account insurance plans at low premiums, high deductible, but you had to join a nonprofit organization in order to be eligible to get into this particular insurance company, and this insurance company wasn't the only one that was selling these.
Yeah.
And when you joined the nonprofit organization, you had to pay a membership fee. And then I read that this particular nonprofit organization that I had to join in order to get into this insurance plan gave $200,000 to Bush's reelection campaign.
Oh, geez. Okay. Claudia, thank you for that. Wow. Again, the danger of individual stories, but yeah, I mean, you got a for-profit system, you got a bunch of politicians who are working off profit that's motivating them. What do you expect? Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com on the web. Victoria, welcome.
Well, good afternoon. How are you?
I am better than Tony Snow, hopefully.
Yes.
It's sad news that he has metastasized cancer.
Very sad news, yes. It's spread, and Dana Perino was very careful to say metastases in the plural, including liver. So I think we can get from that that that's not the only place that it's gone, but certainly it has gone to his liver.
Yeah.
And he believes in treating his cancer very aggressively, which is why he decided that he wanted this thing just taken out completely, even when they didn't know what it was. And at the time that he had the operation yesterday, they thought that it was non-cancerous, which is why this was, it's not a shock if you've already had cancer, but it was a bit of one. So he's discussing with his doctors, but I'm pretty sure that there'll be chemo and who knows what else, but he will address this very, very, very deliberately and very aggressively. And I just have to say that the atmosphere here in the White House press corps is really quite downbeat, because no matter what people think of his political opinions or how people get frustrated when sparring with him, he is universally liked.
Yeah, I've gotten that sense from talking with you guys who, you and Ellen who know him, that he seems to be underneath it all a decent person. And certainly I've, a number of the conservatives that I debate on this program, I have a lot of respect for as human beings. I think they're wrong politically, but they're decent human beings. I'm curious, Victoria, if, when the Edwards made their announcement about Elizabeth Edwards' cancer, Limbaugh rushed right out and said, oh, this is, I don't even want to characterize this as Limbaugh, because it was a number of conservative commentators were putting out a whole variety of talking points that basically fell into the category of he's going to use this for political advantage, or he's trying to get the sympathy vote, or he's using this to change the topic away from away from all the media coverage on Hillary and Obama and to him. And I wonder if those same conservative commentators are going to suggest that Tony Snow is going to use this as a way of changing the topic away from the problems of Mr. Gonzalez, et cetera.
I think I can say with a certain amount of certainty that they will not be saying that.
Yeah.
and I think I can also say with some certainty that they didn't have much to say after John Edwards' appearance on 60 Minutes, when he flat out told people not to vote for him if they were voting for him out of sympathy.
Yeah. Yeah. He was quite unequivocal, and Katie Couric's technique of some people say it was so Fox News-ish, it frankly was disappointing. What can you say? She's been through a lot of tragedy in her life, too, and I suspect that colored her perspective. But it's very clear to me that the Edwardses believe that there is this larger mission that they're pursuing, which is, possibly even saving all life on Earth if you entirely adhere to Al Gore's perspective, that there's work to be done here, and that maybe the most important and valuable thing that you can do if you only discover that you have a short amount of time left on this Earth is to do that work that's going to save the world.
I think that's right. I get the impression that that is the kind of perspective that they have, that, that certainly was the perspective that Elizabeth Edwards had when she pretty much said to John Edwards, you know, that, that you have to go on, we have to go on, that this is how much she believes in it. And I think for Tony Snow also, you know, he is so very much a strong believer in the Bush administration's goals that as soon as he can get back behind that podium, he will be there. And it won't be out of any kind of grandstanding. It'll be because he really believes in the job that he's doing.
Yeah, yeah. Which is hard to imagine, but
fascinating.
Easy to respect.
It's fascinating.
Yeah,
it I know.
So real quickly, we just have a couple of seconds. Victoria, any congressional investigations going on? I mean, is there any news that's going to seep out around all this healthcare stuff?
I'm not sure there's any news that's going to seep out, really. The Senate Judiciary Committee is holding hearings today with
this woman, Monica Goodling, who has said she's going to plead the Fifth. Is she going to be the Monica who brings down this president?
She may well be. She's certainly not going to do him any good.
Wouldn't that be incredibly ironic if they gave her immunity, which it seems to be what she's looking for, and then she dropped a bomb?
It would be quite extraordinary. This thing just gets weirder and weirder.
Another president brought down by another Monica. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Victoria. 57.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
So here's the story from the Associated Press, Dateline Dubai, United Arab Emirates. The U.S. Navy on Tuesday, that's today, began its largest demonstration of force in the Persian Gulf since the 2003 invasion of Iraq, led by a pair of aircraft carriers and backed by warplanes flying simulated attack maneuvers off the coast of Iran. Welcome back to the third hour of our program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you. The maneuvers, writes the whoever the author of this AP piece is, the shall we say, writes the Associated Press, the maneuvers bring together two strike groups of U.S. warships and more than 100 U.S. warplanes to conduct simulated air warfare in the crowded Gulf shipping lanes. U.S. exercises come just 4 days after Iran's capture of 15 British sailors and Marines, who Iran said had strayed into Iranian waters near the Gulf. Britain and the U.S. Navy have insisted the British sailors were operating in Iraqi waters. They go on to say that a French naval strike group led by the aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle was operating simultaneously just outside the Gulf, but the French ships were supporting NATO forces in Afghanistan and not taking part in the U.S. maneuvers. Overall, the exercises involved more than 10,000 U.S. personnel on warships and aircraft, making simulated attacks on enemy that would be Iranian shipping with aircraft and ships, hunting enemy that would be Iranian submarines, and finding mines. U.S. Navy Commander Kevin Ondal says what it should be seen as by Iran or anybody else is that it's for regional stability and security. These ships are just another demonstration of that. If there's a destabilizing effect, it's Iran's behavior. Now, you know, that back to, I mentioned this in the first hour of the program, but I think that it really deserves more than just a mention. Oh, and by the way, speaking of war and war profiteering, just to digress for a moment, Halliburton is opening a factory, a manufacturing facility to make the stuff that they sell to oil drilling operations. They call them energy services projects. The factory that they're opening in Mexico, 9,200 square meters, a huge manufacturing facility. They said Halliburton's chose the state of Nuevo León for its economic leadership, says Tony Wham, vice president of manufacturing at Halliburton. That would be a code for cheap labor? Yeah, I think so. I think we can safely say so. Anyhow, Operation Bite. What alarms me so much about this, and there's Pinch Tejano is blogging about this over at the Daily Kos, but this has been around for some time now. It was over the weekend that I tracked down the Italian site and ran a Google translation of it, and I shared part of that, you know, rather bad Google translation in the first hour of the program here. And that is from the Russian, I'm sorry, it was a French translation. This is from the Russian news site, the website for the Russian news and information agency, Novosti. And they say that on April 6th, we're going to attack. Now, this is what's amazing about this is, and this is now being reported over at Intel Daily, is that none of the corporate media in the United States is covering this. And yet, you can find links to Russian websites, Italian websites, German websites, French websites for major newspapers that are discussing this at length. So the rest of the world is having a debate about this, and we in the United States, by and large, don't even know about it. Here's the news story. This is by Webster Tarpley at IntelDaily.com. The long-awaited U.S. military attack on Iran is now on track for the first week of April, specifically from 4 a.m. on April 6th, the Good Friday opening of Easter weekend, writes the well-known Russian journalist Andrei Uglanov in the Moscow weekly Argumenti Nedeli. Uglanov cites Russian military experts close to the Russian general staff for his account. The attack is slated to last for 12 hours, according to Uglanov, from 4 a.m. to 4 p.m. local time. Friday is the Sabbath in Iran. In the course of the attack, codenamed Operation Bite, about 20 targets are marked for bombing. The list includes uranium enrichment facilities, research centers, and laboratories. The U.S. attack plan reportedly calls for the Iranian air defense system to be degraded, for numerous Iranian warships to be sunk in the Persian Gulf, and for the most important headquarters of the Iranian armed forces to be wiped out. Now, that's part of the story. Where it gets really weird is where the Russian journalist who wrote this, and this as I said, there's a raging debate about this going on in Europe, and it's not being discussed in the English language press in the United States, or as far as I can tell in the United Kingdom, at all. The totally bizarre part of this is that Ishinov, this Russian journalist, he says, these attacks could paralyze everyday life, that we're going to use tactical nuclear weapons to take out the Iranian nuclear industry. These attacks could paralyze everyday life, create panic in the population, and generally produce an atmosphere of chaos and uncertainty all over Iran, Ishinov told RAI Novosti. And then he says, now listen to this. Then he says, quote, this will unleash a struggle for power inside Iran, and then there will be a peace delegation sent in to install a pro-American government in Tehran. Does this sound familiar? This was the original neocon plan for Iraq as well. It was to throw the cards up in the air, and when it comes down, it's going to come down all organized into a nice little corporate castle. No, it's not going to be messy. Democracy will emerge, of course. A democracy that's very laissez-faire, a democracy that favors oligarchies, the wealthy, the democracy that doesn't allow labor unions, you know, the kind of democracy that we created in Iraq when we changed their constitution. A democracy that allows multinational corporations to invest as much as they want. People can't cross the border unless they're coming to work for a multinational corporation, in which case it's easy to cross the border. But otherwise, no, they can't. We're going to seal the borders. But multinational corporations, there are no borders. The world is flat for them, don't you know? Haven't you read Tom Friedman? So you want to buy oil from Iran? It's the same as buying oil from New Jersey. No big deal. Among the other outcomes, this, again, back to this article from IntelDaily.com. Among the other outcomes, General Ishinov pointed to a partition of Iran along the same lines as Iraq and a subsequent carving up of the Near and Middle East into smaller regions. Quoting the general, quote, "This concept worked well for them in the Balkans and will now be applied to the greater Middle East," end quote. Well, that's what Joe Biden is suggesting we should do with Iraq. And by the way, at this point in time, probably makes a lot of sense. But here's the amazing part of this. As the blogger Pinche Tejano over at the Daily Kos notes, "If we use nukes to stop a nuke program," he writes, "the American dream is over. Stick a fork in America because we're done." And I agree with him. It'll paralyze life in Iran. It will paralyze life in Iran. It will create political chaos. And out of that political chaos, what's going to come? Not anything that looks like democracy. When people are attacked, they rally around a strong leader. Just look at 9/11 in the United States. And what did that bring us? And it brought us a guy who says,
"If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier." Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yeah. And that's the exact same thing that will happen in Iran, is the people will rally around the Ayatollahs. I mean, this is a nation that has stood independent for well over a millennia, for well over 1,000 years. What, you think that tomorrow they're going to say, bring another Shah in? Isn't the Pahlavi family still around there? His grandson, or is it his son? I believe it's his grandson, is living in the United States. Let's just bring him in. If there is any shred of credibility to this account, we are headed for a disaster. And if there isn't, then it should be discussed openly in the American mainstream media. Instead, they want to obsess on Tony Snow's cancer. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Program, 21 minutes past the hour. Iran would be tackled at the beginning of April, according to Russian military experts. The analysts affirm, this is the translation, this is the Google translation of the French version of the Russian website, the Russian newspaper Novosti. Здравствуйте, товарищ, Novosti. The analysts affirm that Strike Them American will be launched from the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, from where will take off the bombers with long operating range B-52 with on their onboard cruise missiles by the embarked aviation of the American aircraft carriers deployed in the Gulf and belonging to the 6th American Fleet in the Mediterranean. Cruise missiles will also be drawn from the submarines concentrated in the Pacific and off Arabia. Result? The Iranian nuclear program will be rejected several years behind. In private talks, American generals suppose that the times of deployment of American anti-missile defense in Europe can be deferred to later. Another event envisaged, the oil barrel could fly away to $75 to $80, and this for one prolonged period. Well, that's going to make Bush and his campaign donors very happy, actually. As the price of oil goes up, look at the record profits, ExxonMobil and Chevron and Shell and everybody, all these. And one of the points that this Russian, according to the Russian weekly magazine Argumentari Nedeli, a military action will proceed during the first week of April before Easter Catholic and Orthodox. This year they are celebrated on the 8th, when the Western opinion is on leave. Western opinion is in quotes. And again, this, as I said, this is a translation by a machine translation from the French. In other words, the Western media, Good Friday, there is no more dead news day in the United States other than possibly the Friday that would precede Christmas if Christmas fell on a Saturday, then Good Friday. Everybody's doing their Easter stuff, or they're, I mean, it's just, you know, nothing happening. It's not a news. People are getting together for their families. They go on to say, it may also be that Iran has struck on Friday 6th public holiday in the Muslim countries. In other words, this is the Friday. This is the Arabic Shabbos, the Arabic Sabbath. A Muslim, Sabbath is Fridays, and so you strike them on Friday. According to the American diagram, it will be a striking of one day only, which will last 12 hours, 4 hours of morning at 16 o'clock in the afternoon. In other words, from 4 a.m. to 4 p.m. The code name of the operation is to date Operation Bite. That's interesting. The translation that it translates into is something that I'm not quite sure I can even say on the radio, so I won't. A score of Iranian installations should be touched, with their number, centrifugal machines of uranium enrichment, centers of studies, and laboratories. But the first block of the nuclear thermal power station of Bokhir will not be touched. On the other hand, the Americans will neutralize the DCA, will run several Iranian buildings of war in the Gulf, and will destroy the stations, keys of command of the armed forces. As any measurements which should remove in Tehran any capacity to counteract, Iran projected to run several tankers in the Straits of Hormuz with an aim of cutting the provisioning of the international markets of oil and of striking with the Israeli missiles. Now, again, keep in mind this isn't the world's best English here that I'm sharing with you, but you get the gist of it. I mean, this thing has been war gamed out in extraordinary detail. The text envisages sanctions against 10 Iranian public companies and to 3 companies concerned with the body of the Guards of the Islamic Revolution. That would be the Revolutionary Guard, unit of elite to the orders of the spiritual leader of the Islamic Republic, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Sanctions are also envisaged against 15 physical people, 8 leaders placed high in companies of state, and 7 characters, keys with the body of the Guards of the Islamic Revolution. Now, Cy Hirsch has told us that for, and others, but Cy Hirsch, the most credible of the reporters, that for almost a year we have had special operations people inside Iran. We have been supporting MEK, which is the Iranian version of is a terrorist group inside Iran that terrorizes people, you know, an anti-government terrorist group. It would be, you know, if Al-Qaeda was in the United States, it would be like supporting Al-Qaeda in the United States. We're supporting MEK inside Iran, an anti-Iranian government terrorist group. Terrorist with a T, terrorist group. And so, maybe all this stuff is coming together. Maybe this grand confluence is coming. And if so, on the 6th of April, let's just hope that the sunshine, the light of the sanitizing sunshine of publicity might slow this thing down or stop it. Because the last thing the world needs is a nuclear attack in Iran. 27 minutes past the hour.
A little bit of guitar, a little bit of truck, a little bit of hound dog, and a little bit of luck. A little bit of bacon, a little bit of beans, a little bit of you loving up on me. A little bit of how it's supposed to be, a little bit of life.
And welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, 34 minutes past the hour. Leah in Florida, welcome to the program, Leah.
Hi there. You sound so cheerful.
Well... I don't know.
It's terrible.
I know it is, but you've got to, you're going to get through life. You've got to figure out a way to make it better. And I really think that if we talk about this, we might prevent it.
Well, that's true. My comment, I'm usually fairly articulate, but when I get angry, I don't know, it sort of goes out the window. I grew up during the Cold War in Florida during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and in school we were taught how much radiation was in what bomb and how far the radiation would go and what a nuclear blast would be like. I mean, the whole caboodle.
So I hear anybody
say tactical nuclear weapon. I think people today have not been taught that the radiation doesn't just, like, you know, evaporate. It stays there, and it stays there depending on what kind it is for maybe a million years, maybe 5 million, maybe a billion. That's the half-life of it. Then another
especially half-life, the plutonium.
And so on. And if we use tactical, aside from the fact that we just shouldn't even be thinking about attacking Iran, if we use tactical nuclear weapons, that's the most disgusting, I can't even think of a word for it.
I spot on, Leah, and thank you for saying it. You're absolutely right, and it would be declaring nuclear war, and the fact that these guys think that they might do it, I mean, it's just mind-boggling. Mark in Arcata, California, listening on KGUE. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Yeah, I don't think that an attack would cause chaos in Iran. I think it would actually further unite both Sunni and Shia Muslims, because if you
my opinion too. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, yeah, if you look at the countries allied in the war on terror with the West, with the U.S., like Pakistan and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, their populations are becoming more and more against those regimes. And so establishing a regime from the West in Iraq, I believe, in Iran would be totally impossible. And I think, number one, we wouldn't even have to have this discussion if our Congress would just step up and cut off funding. But yet we've got these neocons in sheep's clothing like Chuck Rangel and yourself who want to use a perverted logic like this to support a draft instead of just saying, let's cut off funding.
All right. Well, thank you for your perspective, Mark.
Yep.
I don't consider myself a neocon. I'll just put that on the record at all in any way. Phil in San Diego. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hey, thanks for being there, Tom. This Saturday, March 31st, is Muhammad's birthday. So I don't know if this is part of their plan of having like a week later celebration. To me, it's pretty obvious now why Halliburton is heading on over to Dubai. I guess they got their walk-in papers from Cheney when he went over there to schedule all of this stuff to happen. You know, it's pretty obvious.
That's interesting. You know, Halliburton going to Dubai in order to be where the action is, or, you know, on the other hand, I mean, if there's going to be a nuclear war in the region, are you sure you want to move into the backyard of where the mushroom cloud is going to be? I don't know, Phil. But thanks for the call. Interesting comment. Lillian in Manitoba, Canada. Hey, Lillian, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hi, Tom. There is something that I absolutely can't understand. Iran watched what happened to Iraq. Saddam's dead. I mean, how many tens or hundreds of thousands of civilians are dead? Their country is practically destroyed. And, I mean, other than being masochists, like, what on earth do they have to gain by practically inviting the U.S. and Israel to attack them? I don't understand it. Like, it would be so easy, it seems to me, just to back off. And just stop this, unless they really believe that the U.S. and Israel will attack them regardless of what they do, the way they were determined.
I think they're looking at Kim Jong Il. First of all, keep in mind, Iran is not Iraq. Iraq, we had totally wiped out their air force. We had degraded their military to the point that, you know, a significant fraction of them were literally dressed in rags. You know, basically civilian clothing. They're We had basically wiped out that country. They had no weapons of mass destruction. They had virtually nothing. Even in the last couple of days before we started bombing them, Saddam was out blowing up his own missiles because they were 10 kilometers longer in range than what the UN allowed for. Literally, just 10 kilometers, you know.
Well, I had the same feelings about Saddam. I mean, his option was to go and live off in some other country and with a whole bunch of money, and he was too stupid to take them up on their offer. I'm sure they would have attacked anyway, but still, yeah.
My point is Iran has an air force. Iran has a military. Iran has warships. Iran has a whole bunch of stuff Iraq did not have. They're twice as large. They're several times as large physically. They're about twice as large population-wise.
But they don't have nuclear weapons, do they?
No, and that's why I said, you said, why are they doing this? And look at what we just did with Kim Jong-il. We just offered to give Kim Jong-il. In fact, we just yesterday flew an envoy over to China, over to Macau, to China and then to Macau, to unfreeze $25 million of Kim Jong-il's money that we're holding. We're going to hand that money to him in order to get him to stop his nuclear program at this point because he's already built a couple of bombs. And
well,
so the Iranians are looking at the North Korea situation and saying, okay, this guy was belligerent, built a bomb, showed them he had a bomb, and all of a sudden the United States starts getting friendly and starts giving him money. So what should we do?
Well, I guess here in Canada we feel that Israel has absolutely no interest in what's happening in North Korea, and they care what happens in the Middle East, and that really is, you know, what is counting at this point.
Yeah, I'm not so convinced that this is all about Israel. I think that this is really more about a philosophy that you will find well entrenched in the United States and in the United Kingdom, this neoconservative philosophy that if you can just shake up the world badly enough, you can maintain empire. You can get your tentacles in there, and then it's being driven by a multinational agenda as much as anything else. And I mean, the Iranians have to be looking at the different examples of Saddam and Kim Jong-il. Saddam said, okay, we don't have any weapons of mass destruction. Come on in and look. You know, he gave absolutely open access to Mohammed al-Baradei and Hans Blix, and they said so before the UN. We can go anywhere. They don't even have guys with us anymore. We can go anywhere. We're waking people up when we show up at facilities. They're not expecting us. And he destroyed all his weapons. He had nothing, and he said to the world, I got nothing. Come on and look. I got nothing. And what do? We bomb them. We blow up his country, and we kill him. On the other hand, Kim Jong-il says, ha ha, I got nuclear weapons, and I'm building nuclear weapons, and you can't stop me. And what do? We're giving him $25 million. The Iranians have to be saying, you know, with regard to us, look at what they do, not what they say.
Well, I just can't believe that I guess I just don't understand why they're not taking this extremely seriously, especially when the U.S. is talking about any kind of a nuclear strike. It's just, I don't know. I just think they should, just for now, just back off and just, you know, you're killing your own citizens.
No, I agree with you, and that's exactly what Saddam said, and Bush attacked him anyway.
Right.
And they just have to be looking at that. I think that they're going for deterrence, that they're trying to have something that will deter us from attacking them like North Korea now has. I just, you know, I'm just convinced that that's the case. Lillian, thanks for the call. From Lillian in Manitoba to Lillian in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Lillian.
Oh, yes, thank you, Tom. I heard on the radio last night that the original attack was supposed to be for April 7th, but now it will be scheduled for April 17th, 18th, and 19th. And Admiral Fallon will be in charge of the invasion.
Where did you get that information?
Well, it was on a program called Coast to Coast with George Nuri. And a remote viewer was on, a very world-famous remote viewer, and he has friends and contacts in Pentagon and in the military.
Yeah.
And he said that it's known all over Europe, but we don't know about it here, but it's April 17th, 18th, 19th, Admiral Fallon, 233 air attacks, sites, and they will probably be funding an insurgency. We will probably be funding an insurgency.
We already are, Lillian. We're funding MEC, which is the local terrorist group, and we're funding anti-Iranian government groups inside the country. Thanks for the call, Lillian. John in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, John.
Hey, I think that there's something more to all this reporting simply because it flies in the face of all conventional military wisdom to let everybody know when and where and, you know, you're going to attack them. So
which
I don't
may
know.
Be why the U.S. corporate media is not reporting this story at all, because they got a call from somebody at the Pentagon saying, you really wouldn't want to blow a national security secret, would you?
Well, yeah, but if the Russians are reporting it, then the Iranians have to know, you know, that this is going on. And so, I mean, I don't know whether they're throwing it out there as a to distract, to do something, you know, maybe they're trying to trigger Iran to do something first. Maybe, you know, there's, I don't know what the heck they could
be doing. Which brings us back to the to today's news in the Associated Press, and this was not announced in advance to the best of my knowledge. The U.S. Navy on Tuesday began its largest demonstration of force in the Persian Gulf since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. We've got more than 10,000 U.S. personnel on warships. We're flying simulated attacks over 100 U.S. warplanes against Gulf shipping lanes, against Iran, against, you know, taking out Iranian submarines, ships, you know, against... Yeah, you know, just this whole thing. It's a, and then we have a U.S. Navy commander, Kevin Amdahl, who says these ships are just another demonstration of that. If there's a destabilizing effect, it's Iran's behavior. So what? What should be seen by Iran or as anyone else is that this is for regional stability and security. We're over there thumping our chest and saying war, war. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news 9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Dan in San Diego, California. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
I wanted to talk about the Edwardses, but I had to throw something in on the Iran attack. I mean, sure. They're ignoring the and-then-what part, you know. So they
right.
attack, and then what do you do next, you know?
Right, we've seen this movie before.
Yeah. Anyway, about the Edwardses and wanting to, you know, better the country and so on and so forth, I think mm-hmm. the right wing may legitimately not understand the Edwardses wanting to do that because, you know, to them, personal sacrifice is a foreign concept. You know, they're willing to sacrifice somebody else's money, family, kids, whatever, but not their own, and it's like, you know, the Warren Buffett and Bill Gates giving away their money, you know, they just don't understand it. It's just totally foreign.
I think you're absolutely right, and that was the point that I was making, and I think it was the first hour, maybe it was the second hour of the program. No, it was the first hour, was that when Katie Couric was faced with the choice of enhancing her career or being there with her husband, and I don't want to judge her on this at all. I mean, it's got to be an incredibly difficult one choice. I'm assuming that she did whatever, you know, that family did whatever was the best thing for that family. Let's just give them totally the benefit of the doubt. But the bottom line was the choice was between, you know, personal ambition and, you know, become, you know, get more viewers, make more money, become the CBS News first anchor woman, or actually I think Connie Chung was, but in any case, be there and be famous, or you know, be with your family, be with your husband through a time of tribulation and all that kind of thing. And
yeah.
There's that third option that you were just talking about that wasn't part of her consideration or equation. And I don't think that she, throughout the entire conversation with the Edwardses, they kept telling her over and over again about this third option, and I don't think that she ever heard it.
Yeah.
And I don't think, and I agree with you that the conservatives don't hear it either, because they believe that government is fundamentally not a good thing, and that the only reason that anybody would go into government, and this is the Tom DeLay School of Government, right, the George Bush, Ken Lay, Dick Cheney, Halliburton School
yeah.
of Government, the only reason you go into government is to get rich or get your friends rich, so they'll help get you rich.
Yeah, and I got a last quick comment about, you know, along the same lines of making a sacrifice, I wonder if Tony Snow, if worse comes to worse, will he have a Lee Atwater moment?
Hmm. I don't know. For our listeners who don't know, Lee Atwater died of brain cancer, and on his deathbed, he was the guy who came up, and thank you, Dan, he was the guy who came up with the Willie Horton ads and the idea of the perpetual campaign and that you should use your political office, particularly as president, as a podium to really run the next campaign continuously and try to establish single-party rule. Just, you know, really, really, really heavy-duty, hardball, vicious campaigning techniques. And on his deathbed, he pleaded with his followers to never do what he had done. He realized how destructive it was to the United States. He apologized. He asked for forgiveness. And he said, don't do this. And his main protege, of course, was Karl Rove. So you can see how well that's gone. Dutch in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Dutch, what's up?
Hey, I have a far-out proposition about court-martialing Bush and Cheney. Now, this goes back to 9/11. I'm still seeking justice for the 9/11 people who died, and you know, at times they're forgotten now. Here's a quick scenario, if you'll let me do this, and you can go to my website at www.dutch.mindsay.com and get a full picture of it. Let's say I went through my beginning of the Army training down at Fort Hood, Texas, and outside of Fort Hood is a little town called Killeen. Let's say the camp commander went to Killeen to go to a second grade class on reading, and let's say that the Army had some really tall barracks, and while he's waiting to go into this class, he sees an airplane strike one of the barracks, and he says, oh boy, that's some stupid pilot, because I'm a pilot, and he doesn't do anything. He goes into the class, and he's watching these second graders do their reading program, and while he's in there, his aide comes in and tells him a second plane has struck a second huge barracks right next to the first one.
No, I get the point. I get the metaphor, Dutch, and that commander of that base would be held for dereliction of duty and would be court-martialed for it. And so you're suggesting that we should be court-martialing Bush and Cheney for that, right?
Yeah, because Cheney was down in the bowels of the White House misdirecting the Air Force up in Alaska and northern Canada with false blips on the FAA screen, and then the planes that did get up in the air, the few that were left down here, were out over the Atlantic Ocean 150 miles out.
Yeah, no, this was absolutely tragically mismanaged. Absolutely, I'm right with you, and they should be held accountable for it, and that's probably the largest scandal of 9/11, although who knows what other shoes are going to be dropped. David in New York, real quick, Dave.
Yeah, listen, can you give us a print source or something for that information that you read, that you translated from the Russian or something, or posted on
the... If you go over to the Daily Kos, bloggers, yeah, dailykos.com is the website.
Oh, okay, it's there?
Yeah, one of the bloggers there has links to the French news sources, Italian news sources, German news sources, the original Russian news source. There's a whole bunch of them.
Can you post it or put it to Randy Rose or something like that so we can upload it?
Well, I can't, but I suggest that you just go over to dailykos.com and check it out. I mean, or just Google it, actually. It's spreading across the Internet very, very quickly, although it still hasn't been picked up by any of the mainstream media. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, hold on to your hats as conservative Ilan Giorno and I take on the issue, should Bush be promoting social justice or what Ilan calls American principles of freedom and capitalism in Latin America? In our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, David Weil is here on Full Disclosure, the perils and promise of transparency. As always, the best of the news and your phone calls. Tom Hartman here with you, reminding you, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well,
for exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.